Hello, this is Terry Burdick, reading with you from the Danville Commercial News for the weekend edition, Saturday, April 4th, and Sunday, April, I'm sorry, let's check that up, Saturday, April 5th, and Sunday, April 6th. We'll start today on the front page. We'll move through our local news first, go into the things that are going on around our state. We'll probably finish up with some sports news and particular attention to what's going on in our prep news in our high schools. And we'll also take a break about Midway and look to see read the death notices that were posted as of Friday. So starting off today on our front page, Correctional Center firing range case moves forward. Case management conference set for May 20th. And this is brought to us by reporter Kayla White. More interest is picking up in the case filed with the 5th Judicial Circuit Court between the state of Illinois and several businesses in Danville, including the Seven Point Dispensary in AutoZone. Friday morning, the Honorable Judge Nicholas J. Boileau set a date for a case management conference in the matter for May 20th to give all parties 45 days to get their evidence and witnesses lined up. The firing range, located at Danville Correctional Center, was originally shut down in 1986 when Stanley D. Parr and Gracie Parr, owners of the Redwood Motor Inn, filed a complaint in the Circuit Court of Vermilion County against defendants Michael Neal, warden of the Danville Correctional Center, and Michael Lane, director of Illinois Department of Corrections, according to public record. Stanley also said during the hearing that several bullet casings and projectiles had been found on his land on three separate occasions in 1986 and 1987, including rifle bullets, which expert Robert Lucas testified had a kill range of 1 mile. Seven Point, which is located within the kill zone for those shots, wants to protect its customers against the danger of injury or death from stray gunfire, according to attorney John Beardsley of the law firm Sakely Garrison and Colombo in Danville. Beyond concerns about possible harm, Seven Point is also concerned about noise from the firing range. Seven Point believes its customers, which include a number of military veterans suffering from PTSD, would be bothered and discouraged from patronizing the store by the sound of gunfire coming from the nearby prison, Beardsley said. Jeannie Cook, executive director of Danville Area Convention and Visitors Bureau, expressed similar concerns, especially as it concerns student players and coaches who attend the annual NJCAA basketball conference at DAC and would be staying in the hotels on Lynch Road near the prison. We would lose the conference. Why would they want to send their students to Danville when their sleep will be disturbed all night by gunfire? Cook said, adding that she may file a petition to be added to the case against the state. Ultimately, this is not just an issue for Seven Point, but for all the businesses in the kill zone. The kill zone encompasses a number of businesses, including but not limited to various hotels and Danville's casino, Beardsley said. There has been nearly 40 years of development in the area since the injunction was put in place. I think you will see more businesses getting actively involved in opposing this motion as the case goes on, he added. Julie Thiemer, the attorney for the state, could not speak on record as to the state's motivation to request the overturning of the injunction. At Tuesday's City Council meeting, Austin Johnson, correctional officer and vice president of AFS-CME Council 31, spoke in defense of reopening the firing range. This firing range on the grounds is facing east. It's not facing any businesses. We fire a couple of weapons, a 9mm and a 223 rifle. I'm not an expert, but I don't feel they would be loud enough to actually harm any businesses around there, Johnson said. His primary reason for supporting the range reopening was union concerns over the cost to taxpayers to keep it closed. It costs taxpayers quite a bit of money to send correctional officers 2 hours away to shoot, and it can be a burden on safety and security of the institution for our members, he said. I just ask that you really clearly think about this. The council voted unanimously 13-0 to officially oppose the reopening of the firing range, with City Council Chair Rick Strebing abstaining from the vote. Since the permanent injunction entered on August 10, 1988, the area surrounding the Danville Correctional Center has been developed with numerous businesses, including several hotels and the Golden Nugget Casino, all of which are well within the established killing range, the resolution reads. Through this resolution, the City Council voices its strong opposition to the reopening of the Danville Correctional Center's firing range. Trial and pretrial hearings will be scheduled at the May 20th conference, and Judge Boileau said, adding that both parties will need to prepare witnesses and evidence ahead of that conference. Continuing with front page news, teardown continues. Breezy Tower demolition moving to next stage, again by reporter Kayla White. The next phase of the demolition of Breezy Tower is about to begin. Asbestos removal is expected to be completed next week or the week after, according to David Rue, Director of Public Works for the City of Danville. At Tuesday's City Council meeting, Rue provided an update on the project, saying once the asbestos removal phase is wrapped up, demolition work will transition from internal to external. Residents can expect significant changes to traffic flow in the downtown area, specifically the intersection of Main Street and Vermilion Street, as the demolition begins. According to an April 4th press release, heavy demolition equipment will be arriving downtown Monday, April 7th, meeting on-street parking on the west side of Vermilion Street between Main Street and the first crosswalk on the north side of the Kresge lot will be closed. There also may be intermittent traffic lane closures of Vermilion Street. Beginning Wednesday, April 9th, all traffic lanes, parking spots, and sidewalks from the south side of the courthouse annex on Vermilion Street to the first crosswalk on the north side of the Kresge lot will be closed to both motorists and pedestrians due to the demolition of the annex building. This closure is expected to last up to 2 weeks. There will be no access to the Rita B. Garman Vermilion County Courthouse on Vermilion Street from the north. The courthouse will remain open and function normally, but visitors must approach from the south or east sides of the building, as these will be the only accesses to the courthouse entrance. Courthouse visitors with mobility issues may be dropped off in the main entrance parking lot on the northeast corner of the intersection of Vermilion and Main Streets. During this closure, the city advises courthouse visitors to adjust their arrival times to accommodate anticipated delays and congestion. Businesses north of the county courthouse will remain accessible, with only one handicap parking spot temporarily affected. Safety concerns. Rue urges the public to maintain a safe distance, remain behind fences, and avoid approaching workers to prevent accidents. Spotters will be on site to manage safety concerns, he said. Knowing that this is an exciting project for the community and people are very interested in watching things happen, if you're out and visiting the site and checking out what's going on, please stay back away from the fences, Rue said. Please don't approach the workers as they're focused. I would hate for someone to take their eye off the ball and something happen. Let them do their job first, and we can watch and admire their skill sets from afar, he said. Traffic disruptions will vary in duration. The initial Vermilion Street closure is expected to last 1 to 2 weeks, while the Main Street closure could extend for 1 to 2 months, a timeline Rui said depends on several factors, including weather and the condition of the tower's facade, as ensuring pedestrian and motorist safety remains the top priority. They just want to make sure 100% that passersby are safe before we open up the roads. Our final story today on the front page takes into account DAC news. Schaefer named new dean of nursing at DAC. For Angela Schaefer, stepping into the role of Dean of Nursing at Danville Area Community College feels like coming home in more ways than one. Officially beginning her leadership on January 2nd, Schaefer brings with her not only years of clinical nursing and teaching experience, but also a deep love for DAC and the community it serves. Schaefer is originally from the small town of Royal, and her nursing journey began close to home. She earned her associate degree in nursing from Parkland College, followed by her Bachelor of Science in Nursing and a Master of Science in Nursing Education, both from Western Governors University. Since becoming a registered nurse in 2007, she's worked in neonatal intensive care, labor and delivery, pediatrics, home health, and medical surgical nursing. But if you ask her where her heart is, she'll tell you without hesitation, my passion was working with moms and babies. Schaefer's passion for nursing soon evolved into a love for teaching. While working as a nurse, I absolutely loved every opportunity I had to teach others, she said. Teaching new parents to care for their babies, teaching nursing students, and precepting new nurses all brought me joy. That realization inspired her to pursue her MSN in nursing education and begin what has become a fulfilling second career, preparing the next generation of nurses. She first joined DAC in 2018 as a nursing instructor, but in 2022, opportunity knocked and she accepted a position with Bryan College in Dayton, Tennessee, helping to build and launch a new BSN program from the ground up. While the work was rewarding and the Tennessee mountains were beautiful, Schaefer found herself longing for home. Although I love Tennessee and the work I did there, I missed home and family, she said. I realized that if given the opportunity, I would move back. When the Dean of Nursing position opened at DAC, Schaefer knew it was her chance to return. I was so excited, she said. Not only was it an opportunity to come home and be near my family, but also to return to a school and nursing department that I respected and wanted to work for again. Coming back to DAC nursing has had a sense of coming home. Schaefer's appointment comes at a special time for the college. In 2025, DAC will celebrate 25 years of nursing education. During that time, the program has earned a well-deserved reputation for excellence with accreditation by the Accreditation Commission for Excellence in Nursing, high pass rates on national licensure exams, and a 100% placement rate for graduates. Applications for the fall 2025 nursing cohort are open now and due by May 30th. The associate degree nursing program at DAC was a multi-exit ladder approach, giving students the flexibility to exit after the first year with a practical nursing certificate and qualify to take the NCLEX-PN exam or continue to complete their associate degree and take the NCLEX-RN exam to become a registered nurse. Graduates leave DAC ready to work in hospitals, clinics, physician offices, schools, and healthcare settings across the nation. Many continue their education pursuing bachelor's, master's, and even doctoral degrees, fulfilling the program's mission of lifelong learning. And while nursing education is serious business, Schaefer brings with her a balance of professionalism and warmth that students, faculty, and staff will appreciate. Her focus as dean is clear. My priority is to support our incredible faculty and staff and facilitate their success, she said. The nursing program celebrates 25 years this year, and my goal is to lead the way to greater success in training nurses who will make a difference in our community. Outside of work, Schaefer is every bit as dynamic and interesting as she is in the classroom or clinical setting. She's been married to her husband, Scott, for 13 years and is a proud mother and grandmother. Spending time with my family is my favorite, she says with a smile. In her downtime, she enjoys reading or listening to audiobooks, cycling, a newfound hobby, and tending to her garden. Every spring, you can find me buying too much from the garden center and busy working in my yard, she admits. Schaefer also loves animals and has four dogs. Her heart for service extends beyond nursing. She's traveled to many countries on short-term mission trips and has lived in Guatemala and Belize. As Schaefer settles into her new role, her enthusiasm and commitment to excellence are unmistakable. She knows the challenges and rewards that come from training future nurses. She also knows the impact those nurses will have on patients, families, and the community for years to come. For those considering nursing as a career, Schaefer encourages them to look closely at DAC. You can become a nurse with top quality training, excellent faculty, and a supportive environment, all at a fraction of the cost of a university, she said. It's an incredible opportunity, and the doors it opens are endless. For more information about the DAC nursing program or to apply for the fall 2025 cohort, visit www.dac.edu/department/nursing or contact the DAC nursing department at 217-443-8553 or nursing@dac.edu. Applications are due by May 30th. Taking a look at our community briefs, we have one that is happening after the day of recording. The vendor market is set for May 3rd. Pratt's vendor market is planned for Saturday, May 3rd from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Ellsworth Park. The event is free and will feature more than 130 vendors, face painting, and more. Well, we'll hope they'll have great weather too. Continuing with our local news on page 2, Child Advocacy Center to highlight child abuse awareness at conference. The Vermilion County Child Advocacy Center will host the 3rd Annual Child Abuse Awareness Conference on Friday, April 18th. The free event will be held at Bremer Conference Center at the Danville Area Community College. The Vermilion County CAC, or Child Advocacy Center, has come together with the Vermilion County State's Attorney's Office, Survivor Resource Center, Crosspoint Human Services, Prevent Child Abuse Illinois, and CASA to prevent child abuse in the community. The community is invited to the event, a day dedicated to raising awareness about child abuse. This important event is designed to bring the community together to learn about the signs of child abuse, how to prevent it, and how to protect our most vulnerable population. The day will be packed with informative sessions led by experts in the field and informative speakers who have firsthand experience in advocating for children's safety, a news release states. Speakers include Commander John Wolfluck, Illinois Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, Brianna Williams from the Intelligence and Analysts with the Illinois Attorney General's Office, Master Sergeant Jennifer Smith from the Illinois State Police, Mike Burns, the statewide MDT coordinator with Children's Advocacy Centers of Illinois, Kristen Kaufman, the director of programs with Prevent Child Abuse Illinois, and Hunter LaFave, founder and CEO and instructor at It's In Your Head. Lunch will be provided by Mimi's Kitchen. Don't miss out on this chance to learn, grow, and most importantly, be a hero for the children in Vermilion County. Your participation can make a difference and help ensure that every child has a safe and nurturing environment to thrive in, the release states. To register, please visit... For more information, please contact Jonathan Munoz, the Executive Director at the Vermilion County Child Advocacy Center at 217-806-4800. We've reached the midpoint of our time together. At this time, I'd like to take a break from the news and take a look at what we have in store today for our death notices. In our death notices today, we have two from Danville, Milton Bryant. Funeral service will be held at 2 p.m. on Wednesday, April 9th at Sunset Funeral Home in Danville. Mr. Bryant will be buried at Sunset Memorial Park. Visitation will be held from 1 to 2 p.m. at the funeral home. And again, that's Milton Bryant, whose services will be held at 2 p.m. on Wednesday, April 9th at Sunset Funeral Home in Danville. Our second and final death notice of today is Olivia Jean Hendricks Lomax, age 76, who passed away peacefully on March 6th. Per her wishes, there will be no services, but a celebration of life by her family will be held at a later date. In lieu of flowers, the family of Olive Jean Hendricks Lomax recommends donations be made to the Catlin Fire Department. Let's turn our attention to the news coming from our state. Today's top headline at the state level news is Trump administration blocks more than $400 million in funding for Illinois health programs. And this article comes to us from the Capital News Illinois. President Donald Trump's administration is pulling back $477 million from Illinois that was to be used to prevent infectious disease and treat mental health and substance abuse issues. The Illinois Department of Public Health announced this week the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is taking back $125 million allocated to IDPH and 97 local health departments for infectious disease prevention. Another $324 million appropriated by Congress for future use in preventing and treating infectious disease is also being blocked. Separately, the Illinois Department of Human Services was notified this week that $28 million from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services for mental health and substance use disorder treatment would be terminated. The funds have been appropriated by Congress and the American Rescue Plan Act for 77 Illinois community organizations providing mental health and substance abuse treatment services to residents. This decision to terminate already awarded federal funding will cause immeasurable harm and disruption to the health and safety of the people of Illinois and generate larger expenses in the long run, Governor J.B. Pritzker said in a statement. IDPH's funding for infectious disease prevention would see a debilitating impact, Director Samir Vahara said in a statement. IDPH has been using the funding to track the spread of diseases, invest in lab upgrades, build up the public health workforce, and improve vaccination efforts. A report published Thursday by Trust for America's Health, a nonprofit research organization, ranks states into one of three tiers based on their preparedness for a public health emergency, and Illinois ranked in the middle tier. Illinois is one of 47 states, with detailed surge plans that outline IDPH's ability to handle a sudden surge in testing demand and implement changes like reallocating staff and acquiring supplies, according to the report. Over the past decade, IDPH published several surge plans, including an Ebola virus disease preparedness and response plan in 2019 and a pandemic influenza preparedness and response plan in 2020. A surge plan is a critical indicator of a state's emergency preparedness that demonstrates a state's capabilities to tackle a crisis, the report said. It noted that seasonal flu vaccination rates also give an insight into the state's emergency response capabilities. According to IDPH, about 28% of Illinoisans receive a flu shot for the current season. Continuing impact in our State news, there we go. Despite a Trump order, Illinois won't require voter proof of citizenship. Illinois voters casting ballots in the April 1st consolidated elections will not be required to show proof of U.S. citizenship, despite an executive order issued this week by President Donald Trump. On Tuesday, March 25th, Trump issued an executive order directing federal agencies to implement and enforce a nationwide requirement that voters show documentary proof of U.S. citizenship when they register to vote. Matt Dietrich, spokesman for the Illinois State Board of Elections, said in an email Thursday that under existing federal law known as the National Voter Registration Act, voters only need to sign a sworn statement on their voter registration application that they are a U.S. citizen. He also said Illinois does not require voters to show any type of photo ID at the polls. Among other things, Trump's executive order directs the Federal Election Assistance Commission to amend the federal voter registration form to include a space in which state or local officials are to record the type of citizenship document the applicant provides. It also directs the commission to withhold federal election funds from states that refuse to accept federal registration forms containing the proof of citizenship information. The executive order limits the types of acceptable documents to U.S. passports, state-issued driver's licenses, or identification cards that are compliant with the Federal Real ID Act, official military ID cards that indicate the applicant is a U.S. citizen, or a valid state or federal government-issued photo ID that indicates the applicant is a U.S. citizen. It also directs the Department of Homeland Security, in coordination with the Department of the Government Efficiency, or DOGE, to review each state's publicly available voter registration list alongside federal immigration databases and state records to determine whether they are consistent with voting requirements that prohibit non-citizens from voting. In local crime news, man sentenced to 12 years for failing to register as a sex offender. On April 2nd, David Cox, 52, formerly of Danville, pleaded guilty on two accounts of failure to register as a sex offender, subsequent offense, both Class 2 felonies. Cox was sentenced to 6 years in Illinois Department of Corrections in each case, with sentences to run consecutively for a total sentence of 12 years. Following his term of imprisonment, Cox will serve 1 year of mandatory supervised release. Judge Karen Wall presided over the plea and sentencing. Evidence was presented that on June 23, 2023, Cox was released from the Illinois Department of Corrections and was required to register as a state offender every 90 days for the remainder of his life, as required by law, due to a prior conviction. As of September 18, 2023, Cox had failed to register his address. Officers with the Danville Police Department learned of an address on Collett Street in Danville where Cox was residing. Officers confirmed with another occupant of the address that Cox was living there. When DPD officers arrived at the residence, Cox was located and subsequently arrested. Evidence was also presented in court that Cox had registered with law enforcement that he was residing at an address on North State Street in Danville. Officers learned that he had moved from the residence on April 7th to another residence on East South Street in Danville. And as of April 23rd of 2024, Cox had failed to register his new address as required as a state offender or sex offender. When the defendant was located by law enforcement, Cox acknowledged his duty and failure to register. State's Attorney Jacqueline Lacey thanked the Danville Police Department for their work in locating this offender and ensuring he was held accountable. The Illinois Sex Offender Registration Act was put in place to protect the public, she said. This defendant had many chances to register as required, but chose repeatedly to ignore the law. In our final article today that applies to our state, Illinois unemployment rates are down and jobs nearly unchanged in February. The Illinois Department of Employment Security, IDES, has announced that the unemployment rate fell by 0.1 percentage point to 4.8% in February based on preliminary data provided by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. The revised January unemployment rate was unchanged at 4.9%. The Illinois unemployment rate was down 0.1 percentage point from a year ago when it was 4.9%. The national unemployment rate was 4.1% in February, up 0.1 percentage point from the previous month, making the state's unemployment 0.7 percentages higher than the national unemployment rate. Illinois non-farm payrolls remained nearly unchanged in February at minus 0.1%, while the January monthly change in payrolls was revised from minus 1,100 to minus 4,400. The industry sectors with over-the-month job increases included construction, trade, transportation, and utilities, and professional and business services. The industry sectors with the largest monthly payroll job decreases included government, leisure and hospitality, and private education and health services. It's been a few weeks since we've heard from Kevin Cullen, the Irish hiker. Let's take a look at his feature article today, or his column, Remembering Some of Danville's Greatest. Newspaper reporters simply don't ask famous people for autographs, but I simply couldn't resist doing so when I met Gene Hackman, Dick Van Dyke, Jerry Van Dyke, Bobby Short, and Donald O'Connor at the Gala 1988 benefit for the Fisher Theater. I covered the press conference in the stately Hegeler home, which preceded a gourmet food and champagne event that drew 350 donors at $1,000 each. Later, I hit the loud 45-minute fun-filled gathering for 1,500 at the Civic Center. There, admission was $15 a head. It was the first and last time that all five stars appeared together. Today, only Dick Van Dyke survives, and he's 99 years old. May 23, 1988 was a night to remember, and I've been remembering it a lot following the recent tragic death of Gene Hackman, 95. The two-time Oscar winner grew up in Oak Lawn, a blue-collar neighborhood on Danville's east side. His dad and uncle were commercial news printers. A grandfather was a commercial news reporter. Speaking of the Black Tie event at the Hegeler House, Hackman said, "We were all surprised when this thing finally came off. I expected a call saying that only 8 people were going to show up. I don't know of any friends in town who could afford to come to this party," Dick Van Dyke said with a laugh at the Hegeler House at 1521 North Vermilion Street. All five of the hometown heroes wore tuxedos. At the press conference, they were seated around a big oak table littered with cords and microphones planted by radio and TV stations. Hackman clearly loved recalling his childhood in Danville. "I went to 2 auditions for the Red Basque Players, the local theater group, and I froze. I couldn't do it," he said. He was once a Fisher Theater usher and managed the old Lincoln Theater. After leaving Danville High School, he served in the Marine Corps, took classes at the University of Illinois, and worked as a cameraman for WDAN-TV. He began his acting career relatively late, at age 25, in New York City. When he was a boy, he often dreamed of living behind the stately white pillars of the Hegeler home. "If you dream of becoming an actor, you have a lot of fantasies," Hackman said. "Some of them come true and some of them don't. This house was a boyhood fantasy of mine. This was the important house in town." Hackman said that he saw his first live performance in 1938 at the Fisher. Ethel Barrymore starred in The Corn is Green. The experience sparked his interest in acting. "I took a telegram to her backstage," he recalled. "I was terrified, so I slipped it under the door." Years later, whenever an aspiring young actor sought his advice, Hackman said, "I tell them to go to New York and put some time in. When I get through with my advice, they just nod and say they want to go to California and do some commercials." The ever-funny Dick Van Dyke delivered some of the more memorable quips and quotes, such as, "Danville has about the same population now as it had years ago," said the star of the legendary Dick Van Dyke Show, "plus many stage and music roles. Every time a baby is born, some guy leaves town. I feel that I owe the Fisher Theater something," he added. "The sister of my girlfriend in high school worked in the Fisher box office, so I never had to pay to get in. This will clear my conscience." "Danville's a very magic town, and it always will be," Van Dyke said. "Whenever I come back here, I feel like I'm 15 again. Every time I come to Danville, I realize that I haven't changed at all. I get this terrible feeling in my stomach because the test is tomorrow and I haven't cracked a book. I'm in love with Nancy Frankenberger. I've got the worst case of acne in medical history. I'm the only one who doesn't have a car." "My fondest memories are of my life in Danville," said younger brother Jerry Van Dyke, who was a well-known comedian and TV actor. He later starred in the hit series Coach. "This really was my home," said O'Connor, a movie star, song and dance man who was part of a vaudeville family. "We're all here because we want to do something for the town. I'm very proud of my family and proud of my friends here." "I was lucky to have been born here," said Short, singer and pianist at New York's exclusive Cafe Carlyle, a favorite of Woody Allen and Jackie Kennedy Onassis. The Civic Center gathering featured lots of razzle-dazzle, wit, and charm. The impromptu stage show included a hat and cane dance, quips, and lots of reuniting with friends and teachers from long ago. I'm afraid that we've really run out of time today. I hope you enjoyed these comments and memories from Kevin Cullen, the Irish hiker. We'll get together again this time next week. This has been Terry Burdick reading to you from the Commercial News, the weekend edition, for April 5th and 6th. I look forward to reading again with you soon. Have a great week.